The actual title to my lesson is Evolution or Creation More Credible? Maybe you heard the gorilla at the zoo. He was sitting in his cage and before him sat the Bible on one hand and Darwin's Origin of Species in the other. And he looked back and forth between the two, and the crowd began to gather in front of his cage, and they sat and watched as he had a puzzled look upon his face. Someone finally asked, "What's wrong? What's bothering you?" And he says, "Well, I don't know if I am my brother's keeper or my keeper's brother." Even he was having a problem trying to determine what was more credible. Is it the Bible story of God's creation, or is it Darwin's theory of evolution? You know, the debate that's been going on between these two has been going on for some time, and there are a lot of people who are puzzled. Hopefully no one sitting here in this audience, hopefully no members of the church are even questioning which of these is more credible. But to those people around us, and maybe to our children, because it is being taught in the school systems. I'm a teacher, been teaching for fixing to start my 19th year. I'm a math teacher. But I have friends that are teaching biology, and many of them are required to teach evolution. Not simply as a theory anymore, but to teach evolution as fact. That this is the way that our world evolved and came into being. How life as we know it came to be. And for some people, it can be confusing. When you see scientists and look at textbooks that say so assuredly that this is the way that things happen. Howard Hendricks once made the statement, "In the midst of a generation screaming for answers, Christians are stuttering." And sometimes we do. Sometimes we do hesitate and what we say and hesitate to back up what we believe and what we stand for. And when we talk about this particular topic, we shouldn't stutter. There should be no question as to what we believe and where we stand, and we need to be crystal clear about what we believe, and we need to share that with those round about us, because the scientific world is screaming from the mountaintops that there is no God, that evolution is the answer to where did life begin. A number of years ago, a man by the name of Ronald Keith Williamson was convicted of a brutal murder in the state of Oklahoma. After he was convicted, Williamson continued to plead and to argue that he was innocent of this crime. The main evidence that was used in the testimony against Williamson was that of an expert who had analyzed four hairs that came from the crime scene. There were some that were found on the body of the victim and some that were in the room. And this expert said that these were a match for samples that were taken from Williamson's hair. Williamson spent 12 years in prison. The biggest part of the time he was awaiting execution. But there was one problem. He was innocent, just as he claimed. And as time passed by and DNA testing and DNA evidence became more useful and advanced, part of his plea, part of his appeal process, he asked that they retest the evidence from his case. And when they retested the evidence, they found that evidence, DNA evidence, pointed to someone else committing this murder. that based upon the samples of DNA that were taken from him, even the hair samples that were taken that convicted him in the first place, they found that there was no way that his DNA matched the DNA found at the crime scene. The hair hadn't really been Williamson's hair. You see, the expert said that it was a match, but really it was only consistent with certain properties of his hair. It had the same color, it had the same texture, and it had the same shape, but there was no way by looking at those hairs that you could prove that one belonged to a certain person. Legal analysts have since said that hair analysis is now considered a pseudoscience, basically meaning a fake or a fraud. Jurors, though, heard impressive testimony from someone who was supposed to be an expert. And he was confident in that testimony. And because of his confidence, they established the guilt of the defendant. A federal appeals court judge called the hair evidence in his case scientifically unreliable. And because of that, other cases were opened and re-examined. Through a 25-year period, there were 18 people on death row, all who had been convicted in the same way. And these cases were reopened, and oftentimes new evidence or new technology through DNA testing even allowed many of those to be found innocent of the crimes they were convicted of. Evolution is also a pseudoscience. There are many people who are vigorously stating that there is fact when there is no evidence at all. The evidence and the testimony seem overwhelming at times, just like in this murder case, but there are major flaws and major holes in evolutionary theory. Michael Denton, who is a molecular biologist, said evolutionary theory is still, as it was in Darwin's time, a highly speculative hypothesis, entirely without fact or without support, and very far from the self-evident axiom that some of its more aggressive advocates would have us to believe. In other words, there is no truth. There is no proof of evolution. There never has been, there never was, and there never will be. It's simply a hypothesis. It's a guess that someone made a long time ago that gives them an excuse to remove God from the picture. In our lesson today, I want us to examine evolutionary theory. And I want us to examine creation, and I want us to see that we can easily come to the conclusion of which one is credible. Not more credible, but which one is credible and which one is false. Evolution has been, and still in some circles today, is the most prominently taught explanation of how our universe came into existence. Lee Strobel said, in the popular culture, the case for evolution is generally considered shut. You can get in many circles and in many places and talk to many people, especially those who have no knowledge of God or those who do not worship God, those who are not committed to their faith in God. They have no doubt that evolution is fact. Time magazine, in the December 31st issue, 1999, had the headline, "Iconoclast of the Century, Charles Darwin." And the first sentence in the article said, "Darwinism remains one of the most successful scientific theories ever promulgated." One of the most successful theories that has ever been brought up, that has ever been introduced. As I said a minute ago, it's taught in school. Not as a theory anymore, but it's taught in school to be fact. and it's reinforced in our museums, it's reinforced in our zoos, it's reinforced even on the TV. You watch cartoons, and it's ingrained in our children's minds that evolution is the way that things came to be. Bob Russell made the statement, evolution has been repeated so often that to challenge it is the equivalent of believing in a flat earth or a moon made of cheese. That's what the scientific community wants. They want people to think that it's so far-fetched to believe anything but evolution that no one questions it. Because if you question it, you see the holes. You see the flaws in the theory. Evolution actually has two subdivisions. One is microevolution and the other is macroevolution. Microevolution exists. And I believe that it is a plausible, a reliable, even an observable occurrence. You see, microevolution says that if we take an individual species or an individual group and we look at that group, we can observe changes within that group. We see it every day. Look in your yard. How many breeds of dogs are there today? I would hate to imagine, especially now, what's the term? I don't remember for the like multi poos and designer dogs. That's the term that's being used now. You know, the dogs have been for centuries bred for different purposes. And we have dogs as large as the Bull Mastiff and the Saint Bernard down to little bitty Chihuahuas and different designer dogs, if you will. That's microevolution. There's a change. There's been an adaptation for need. Look at cows. If you go back 100 years and the cow found on the family farm, you know, may give a gallon or two of milk a day, but now if you look in the dairies, cows have been bred to the point that they can give several gallons of milk each day. That's an example of microevolution. Corn crops. Different crops have been crossbred and so that they can increase their tolerance to drought and even tolerance to herbicides. There's corn now that you can put in the ground and you can come back 2 weeks after it's sprouted and you can spray the whole field with Roundup and it doesn't bother the corn at all, but it kills the weeds around it. We look at germs and viruses and bacteria, how they have developed a tolerance to the different drugs and antibiotics that we throw at them so regularly that now they're not as effective. You see, they've changed. They've adapted to their environment so that they can survive. I think the good Lord in heaven ingrained that even in us so that we can survive, so that we can adapt to our changes. You see, God made a perfect world. And He filled that world with perfect things, and then man became imperfect. And since that day, we have filled this earth, and we've affected this earth, and we've changed this earth to the point that so many things have had to adapt to overcome the things that we have polluted and infected it with, that they've had to evolve and adapt to that. Microevolution is a very believable and real theory, or it's actually, it's not a theory. It's something that does take place. Macroevolution, on the other hand, is what the Darwinists propose. They claim that life began millions of years ago with a single, simple-celled organism that existed and brewed in a gooey pond somewhere, and it came out and it evolved into every life form that we see. Someone humorously coined the phrase, from the goo to you by way of the zoo. That's what they believe. But they have trouble explaining a lot of things. When we look at Darwinist theories. Where is the evidence that evolution ever took place? Where is the fossil evidence of the transitions between the different species? Even Darwin admitted in his book, Origin of Species, he made the statement and he said, the lack of these fossils is perhaps the most obvious and most serious objection to his theory. In Darwin's day, there were some fossils that had been discovered and found that appeared to be these half-species. They appeared to be evolutions from one creature to another. But as more fossils were gathered, and as these were being studied, and as they were being put together, there is no evidence of an evolutionary creature. There's no evidence of a half-ape, half-man. There's no evidence of a half-fish, half-dog that crawled out of the swamp or whatever. This lack of evidence pokes holes in Darwin's theory. The fossil record actually shows that there was a sudden appearance of almost every group of animal that exists today all within the same time period, which is very consistent with Genesis' account of God's creation. There's another rule called irreducible complexity that says that evolution cannot exist. Irreducible complexity says that certain systems cannot be broken down into smaller systems that can still function. Darwin admits this in The Origin of Species as well. He says if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive modifications, then my theory would absolutely break down. Let me give you an example of what irreducible complexity would be. If you took a mousetrap, in order for that mousetrap to work, you need every part of that mousetrap. You need the base. You need the arm or the hammer. You need the spring that flips it over. You need the little arm that latches on to the catch to hold it back. And you need that catch itself. If you remove any of those individual parts, that mousetrap will not function. That is irreducible complexity. You cannot break that mousetrap down any simpler than it is, and it still works. At the same time, evolution says this mousetrap would have began as simply this base, and it would evolve into that more complex organism, and these other parts would form in order to make it work. Well, that mousetrap would not work without those parts. So it could not wait to evolve into what it became. It had to be the full mousetrap from the beginning. Life is that way. If we look at a single cell is made up of just a few basic parts. And if you remove any of those parts from that cell cannot survive. It cannot divide and multiply into the organ that it makes up, into the creature that it becomes. If you take away one part, that cell is destroyed. That cell could not exist and evolve into what it is now because part of those pieces would not be in place. Irreducible complexity rules out evolution. You see, evolution is not a true science. We said a pseudoscience a while ago. True science, the definition of science, is the study of that which is observable and repeatable. You cannot observe evolution. Evolution, according to the theorist, also has not repeated itself. Otherwise, we would still have monkeys walking out of the jungle and becoming people. We would still have creatures crawling out of the ponds and the rivers and the lakes and becoming mammals. Doesn't happen. It hasn't happened. And it never has happened. Scientists and paleontologists and geologists have often turned to some of the prehistoric skeletons of man that have been found to say that these were ape-like men, that these were cavemen, and they were different from what we are today. You know, as I look around this room, I see different people. And I see people of different shape, of different appearance. And science has taken Cro-Magnon man. You've heard of Cro-Magnon man. He was the caveman. He was the closest thing between the ape and the man. And they have examined the skull of Cro-Magnon man and found that really the same parts exist in Cro-Magnon man that exist in all European skeletons today. It's simply that it's a little different shape. But I know people whose heads are a little more pointed than others, whose heads are maybe a little longer or a little wider, or in my case, a little thicker than others. That's nature. We're all different. Cro-Magnon man may have been a little odd looking, but his skeletal makeup is exactly the same as mine and yours today. Biological evolution can only take place after there was some sort of living matter. You see, this is another major flaw in evolution. They cannot explain the existence of life. They say that, well, life began some way, somehow, and it's evolved into what we have today. But Darwinism has no explanation for the origin of life. Lee Strobel says the origin of life is the Achilles heel of evolution. Dr. Walter Bradley, who is a retired professor of mechanical engineering at Texas A&M University, draws an analogy of Darwin's theory along with chance and energy and that equaling what we have today. He says it's sort of like taking an old printing press where you have to set the letters in. As long as there's intelligence behind it, taking those letters and putting them in the order that they should be, you can get something that is of value. But he said it would be taking that printing press and taking that box of letters and throwing them at that printing press and hoping that those letters land upright and in the correct order to make words or sentences or paragraphs. That's what evolution says happened to our world. Our world that is so complex, our world that is so intricate, it just happened to appear. We know if we took that box of letters and we threw it at that printing press, probably would not even print. Because much less the letters landing right side up or even backwards, they're going to clog up that machine. And there's no way that it could work. Chaos cannot produce order. Chaos only produces more chaos. Creation, on the other hand. If we look at creation, the Bible teaches us that our universe and our lives are not the result of chance. They're not the result of happenstance, but they're the result of a loving Creator. It begins, Genesis 1 and verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if we read throughout chapter 1, we see how God created all things that are in the earth. And in verse 26, he says, God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let him rule over the fish of the sea and of the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. You see, we have a record of everything that we know, everything that we see, and how it came into existence. Psalms 19, verses 1 through 3, David said, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where the voice is not heard. You think about the world that we live in. How this earth is the only planet that can sustain life. How we have the only makeup of an atmosphere that is conducive to life. And that's simply by chance. How if you took the earth and you moved it just a few inches closer to the sun, how we couldn't live. We would all burn up. Everything that lives upon this earth would parch and dry and cease to be. But if you moved it just a few inches the other way, the temperature would become so cold that everything would freeze. How is it that earth happened to be in the perfect place? Look at the stars in the sky. David said that everything, the heavens declare the glory of God. How the stars are there in place, and how for centuries man has been able to look to those stars that are constant and be able to guide himself. How the moon that God placed in the sky affects the tides and the currents and the eating patterns of so many creatures. How every creature that's here seems to work with something else to create and to increase life. Been so many articles in the paper looking and talking about how things are stopping, ceasing to grow, and how our gardens are not what they used to be. And we look at how the bees and the insects are not quite as common as they used to be. I know I can go outside. I used to when I was young. I could go outside and run around the yard, and it was hard to run through the yard without stepping on a honeybee. Now I rarely ever see one. And they were designed by God to help to pollinate and help those plants and our gardens to reproduce. And now it seems like we struggle to get things to grow like they should, because through our spraying and poisoning, we've wiped out a lot of the intricacies that God put in place that make life possible. Romans 1 and verse 20. Paul said, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are. Talk about invisible attributes. Think about the force of gravity itself, the thing that holds us to this earth. One of God's attributes. It's a part of God's wisdom, and it shows His infinite wisdom of how all of these things have to work together and have to be in place in order for life to exist. The Bible shows us that the universe was formed not because of blind chance, but because of intelligent design. There's a strong scientific evidence for an intelligent designer. The Darwinists say that there is no such thing. But the theory of evolution is contradictory to one of the scientific laws called the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says that in a system, energy always moves from order to disorder. We talked about the state of our world and how at one time it was perfect. When God made it, it was perfect. And I seriously believe when we look at the Bible and we look at the ages of the those that appeared before the flood and how long that they lived, they were living in a perfect world. And as such, they were able to live and to thrive for so much more and so many more years than we can. But because of that second law of thermodynamics, things have fallen slowly into more and more disorder. The theory of evolution says that it worked backwards, that things went from a disordered state to what we have now, a more ordered state. That's not the way things work. Things always break down and become less complicated rather than more complicated. It would be like saying, if we took a pile of bricks and we took a pile of lumber and we took a couple of boxes of nails and we put them here and stuck dynamite in under it and we pushed that little thing down and it blew up, that explosion would produce a house. We know that that's impossible. But that's just what the Big Bang Theory says that happened. But chaos cannot bring order. Walter Bradley, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, points out that the only time that we see written information, whether it be on the wall of a cave somewhere or whether it be in the Encyclopedia Britannica, whenever we see written information, there is always intelligence behind it. And that's true in our very nature. You know, we use 26 letters in our alphabet to make up the English language, to spell our words, and to communicate. God used basically 4 letters that make up our DNA. Our DNA is what tells our bodies, what tells the very cells their responsibilities and how they are to work. And you put those 4 letters into basically a chemical alphabet. And you combine those into the different sequences or the words that they create. God wrote down within us how we are to react, how we are to work together all of the different parts and pieces, and it shows that intelligent design. Bradley also pointed out, each cell in the human body contains more information than in all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's certainly reasonable to make the inference that this isn't the random product of an unguided nature, but is the unmistakable sign of an intelligent designer. When we compare the two, when we look at what the two theories say, evolution says, first, that everything is Everything is the evidence of a random choice. Where they first said that things began to grow in these little ponds of water, and these things began to come together and to join together, and they created life. But this first theory lost support because when they figured out the possibilities and the odds were so great. You know, we talk about things being almost impossible. We say they're 1 in 1,000,000. Well, this is actually, mathematically, 1 in 10 followed by 60 zeros. Impossible. That random choice is plausible. Then there was the theory of chemical affinity that said that there is an inherent attraction that calls the amino acids, the basic parts of our cells and our makeup, that calls these amino acids to come together and to form living things. But this lost support because when we had the advent of the supercomputer about 40 years ago, they began working on a computer model that would cause this to come to be, but that computer could not put those things together. That computer could not make this theory work with living cells. Then they came up with the theory of self-ordering tendencies. And it says under certain circumstances, systems will actually rearrange themselves to make more complicated forms. But this lost support because They can never find anything that would rearrange to improve itself. But like we said before, always rearranged and broke down. Then they said, well, there's the theory that life was seeded from outer space. That it drifted in and through our atmosphere and landed upon this earth and were the building blocks of all life. But that lost support because there still doesn't prove